We are in the middle of chapter 2, and the first few verses of chapter 2, Paul was laying out the case that the Gentiles had previously been dead. From a spiritual standpoint, they were dead. And this was in direct contrast to the demonstration of God's power that was mentioned at the end of chapter 1. All right, and then as we had continued on through, then Paul had not only drawn that contrast, but then contrasted that point, and talking about that through Christ that then they were made alive. And we've made it up to verse 10, but since we've been gone for about a week, I want to back up just a couple of verses read through that so that we can keep them together in their context. So starting in verse 4, and this is where he was drawing the direct contrast to how the Gentiles before had been dead according to their transgressions and their sins. Verse 4, but God, being rich in mercy because of his great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our transgressions, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved, and raised us up with him, and seated us with him in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus, so that in the ages to come he might show the surpassing riches of his grace and kindness toward us in Christ Jesus. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one may boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them. We had finished up with verses 8 and 9 the last time that we had met. And the one thing that I really want to emphasize here, just very, very quickly, we've talked very, very much so between the last quarter and this quarter about how God's plan for salvation is a salvation that is based on our faith in him, the faith in God that what he has said is true, and that faith in the promises that he will provide to us. And that it is by grace that we are given this opportunity because we don't deserve it. There's nothing that we could do to merit any justification before God. There's no way that we could be acceptable to him. But he loves us anyway. And because he loves us, he has granted us this gift that has opened up the way that if we do have that faith, then we can stand justified before him. But it's not us. That was the thing that we had finished up with in the last time. It's not about us. It's about God. It was his gift to us, not anything that we could do ourselves. And that's what verse 9 is saying. This gift that we are being provided, it's not a result of works. It's not anything that we could do. It's what God, through his mercy, has done. Because if we have the mindset that we are somehow justified to God by the things that we do, then we put those things, just as the Jews did, as a tradition. Okay, we make them a source of pride in ourselves rather than the one who provided us with this path to salvation. So the last part of verse 9, so that no one may boast. We have no reason to boast. Even through this gift that is given to us, we have no reason to boast because we are nothing special in terms of being able to somehow elevate ourselves to bring us closer to God. It was God that through his mercy and through his plan that was founded from the foundation of the world that we are able to approach him. And one thing I want to mention about this before we get into verse 10 is that we need to remember that I think sometimes we make this mistake, that we somehow think that, and this is the same problem that even the Jews had, that justification through the things that we do that are good, okay, that are going to be pleasing to God because he's the one that came up with that, that somehow that we are granted the salvation as if God owes us something. And that is completely opposite the concept that Paul has been trying to teach throughout most of his epistles. But at the same time, I think that we need to be very careful that we don't ignore the fact, as we're about to mention in verse 10, that there are certain works that God had intended us to do. And so this concept of having, and this is where I think various members in the audience have brought this up, where we need to remember that this faith that we have in God is not through works, because the works in and of themselves cannot save us, but that this faith is not in complete exclusion to those works. So we need to make sure that we don't go too far down that path. And we often go to the book of James to demonstrate how those works are essential to the proof of who we are. Okay? All right, any comments before we move on? All right, so in verse 10, "For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we could walk in them." All right, literally this phrase, "for his workmanship," would be translated, "we are a product created." All right, Paul is acknowledging that we are a creation. Okay, and that's on different levels. Physically, we didn't create ourselves. Okay, it was the creator of all that has made us. Okay, if you take a look at Psalms chapter 100, verses 1 through 3, it says, "Shout joyfully to the Lord, all the earth. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before him with joyful singing. Know that the Lord himself is God. It is he who has made us, and not we ourselves. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture." Paul's acknowledging that as those that did not create themselves, we are in no position in any type of authoritative sense to be able to set the standard for what would be acceptable and what is not. But more importantly than the physical creation that we have been given through God, spiritually we are created by God and recreated as we become this new person. Consider Colossians chapter 3, verses 5 through 11. "Therefore, consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which amounts to idolatry. For it is because of these things that the wrath of God will come upon the sons of disobedience, and in them you also once walked when you were living in them. But now you also put them all aside, anger, wrath, malice, slander, and abuse of speech from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you laid aside the old self with its evil practices and have put on the new self, who is being renewed to a true knowledge according to the image of the one who created him, a renewal in which there is no distinction between Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, and free man, but Christ is all in all." So as we put away those old things, as we are embracing the type of behaviors, the type of attitudes that we should have as disciples of Christ, we're made new. That's what renewing is all about. Okay, we are made new. Spiritually, we are recreated in this mindset that God would have us to have. So physically and spiritually, then, he's the one that molds us. He's the one that creates us in his image. And in the next phrase, it says that we're created in Christ Jesus for good works. And there's the purpose. As we are created by God, we are done so for the purpose of these good works. And that illustrates that the life that we have, this holy life that we're supposed to have, is to be that of what God would have. We're to emulate him. We're to emulate Christ and being separate from the way that the world will work, to be pure, to be holy. It's not just a faith in name only. It is a faith in practice. It is a faith in behavior, a walk that imitates our Creator. So there is a goal to this. Okay? Question? Comments? Now, if we can accept that, why do we do that? Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Jews had this, the Jews had Abraham, all this stuff. The Jews knew. I'm always fascinated to see how the Gentiles came into this. You know, and this newness of mind, it's just, to me, it's just wonderful.
Well, and I agree. And even the Jews, those that did accept Jesus, they had revelation, at least in a limited sense, of how this was going to play out. But the Gentiles, having been so far removed, and that's even the type of language that Paul's going to use later on in this chapter, being so far removed to be able to accept this message, to be able to accept the gospel and to begin this walk as being a new created individual spiritually, to be able to perform those good works, that is amazing. Okay, but again, you know, I ask, well, why do we do the good works? If we are created in Christ Jesus for the purpose of performing these good works, well, why do we do them? Because it pleases God. I would hope that would be our answer. Okay. I think sometimes even we are guilty of this. Okay. We take the commandments that we are given, because as was brought up in our lesson on Wednesday night, you know, Christ has all authority in heaven and earth. Okay, so we understand that whatever Christ says, that those are the commands that then we are to follow. But I think sometimes even we are guilty of thinking that, okay, I'm going to fulfill certain parts of those obligations, and then God is going to reward me because, well, I've done something for Him. Take baptism, for example. Okay, I mean, we all understand that that is something that we are commanded to do. It is this way by which we are unified through Christ. Just as He was buried, we also were buried. Just as He arose, that we arise to be in newness of life. But I think sometimes we fall into the trap of saying, okay, well, I was baptized, and therefore God will provide me salvation. As if somehow He owes us because we did a good job. Okay, like a parent kind of patting their child on the head. But that's not the point. Why do we even engage in baptism? It's because we love God. Because we have humility, hopefully that's our attitude, because we have humbled ourselves, and because we understand that it's the right thing to do. Because we love Him. Because we trust in Him. Because we have faith in Him, and therefore we're willing to do whatever it is that we're told to do. Which God prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them. Okay, we've illustrated from the very beginning that God did not come up with this plan as a fly-by-night measure. Okay, this was something that was well thought out. This was something that was in place already from the foundation of the world. And it's amazing to me that, you know, centuries later, all of these threads that seemed to be kind of floating out and did not have much of the way of correlation still came together the way that God had intended. But this idea of what would be a good work so that we would walk into them, God already had those things in mind. Where do we come along thinking that we can then prescribe what is good and what is not? That then takes the onus off of God and His authority and His infinite wisdom and His mercy, and tries to put the wisdom where it does not belong, with us. Who are we to come along and try to say what is going to be good and what is not going to be good? As if somehow we can then take something that would not be pleasing in the sight of God and say, well, but that's okay because, as we justify ourselves. Anybody ever try to do that one? I have. God is the one that made the decision on what would be good and pleasing and acceptable to Him. He doesn't need our help. We can do that ourselves, or He can do that Himself. They were established from the foundation for a purpose, to regulate our lives, to establish a code of conduct, to provide order to our behavior. I mean, think of how many times that we come up with rules that we give to our own children. Do we give them just for the fun of it? Or is there a purpose behind it? I know when I tell Christian and Colin to do something, sometimes they may look at me like, why? And they don't really get it. but we know better. I know that down the road, this is supposed to provide some type of order so that they would grow and be in a safe and successful type of environment. Well, that's what God's plan was. These good works that he established were there for a reason. Who are we to come along and try to change it? We do it because it's what we should do. It's because we love God. In Luke 17, verses 7 through 10, which of you, having a slave plowing or tending sheep, will say to him when he has come in from the field, come immediately and sit down to eat? But will he not say to him, prepare something for me to eat and properly clothe yourself and serve me while I eat and drink, and afterward you may eat and drink? He's not thanked the slave because he did the things which were commanded, does he? So you too, when you do all the things which are commanded you, say, we are unworthy slaves. We have done only that which we ought to have done. If we have the faith in God that we are to have, this faith that Paul has illustrated would lead to salvation, would cause us to be justified beforehand. This faith is not in complete absence of the things that we should do, but it's God who states what we should do. And when we perform those things out of good conscience for him, because we love him, because we recognize that we are unworthy, then we demonstrate this faith that we've been talking about all along. And I think so many people try to separate one from the other, and that's just not the case. All right? Yes, sir. Right.
To be recognized more than anything for the job that they do or the things and works that they do, as opposed to even getting paid. And I think that's just part of our human nature. And that's hard for us because we do these things and sometimes we do them for the wrong motives and the wrong purpose.
Absolutely.
And I think that really is a big part of what you said here. Humbleness is not easy in our nature to humble ourselves.
Oh, absolutely. I think you're 100% on target there. We just, because of our nature, like that pat on the back. I know I do. I don't go around actively every day in my job saying, did I do okay? Did I do okay? Did I do okay? You know, wanting somebody to give me a compliment. I'm not fishing for anything. But at the same time, when we get it, doesn't it feel pretty good? And doesn't that sometimes make us want to work harder so that we can continue to get that recognition? Well, the problem with that is that if you get into that mindset, after a while, it becomes the seeking for recognition that gives us the motivation to do what we're supposed to do instead of the fact that we do it because that's our job. We are unworthy before God. He has provided us, by his grace, with mercy enough so that we can, if we have faith in him, be saved. But he's the one that sets the rules. He's the one that determines what we should be as a person and how we should live to be pleasing to him. So why don't we just do our job? Yes, Jim.
Christianity brought along a different concept to both sides of the issue when the Jews who wanted to do everything by works, the Gentiles wanted to just believe, and then they could do all their bad stuff. As long as they believe, you still have those two
Okay, they're not mutually exclusive. The end game here is recognizing that it's not the works itself that's going to provide the path to salvation. That's what the Jews thought. But we still are required to do those works because, well, God told us to. He's the one that established it from the beginning. He's the one that said, this is good and this is not good. So if we have faith in him, why wouldn't we not walk in accordance with what he's told us that is good? Yes, sir. And we're going to move on. I think you're right.
They don't discuss it. It's politically incorrect. Don't discuss it. We have to, I don't know, I find it very difficult as a Christian to, you understand what I'm trying to say? I'm saying our morality is being adjusted by government. And I think as Christians, I don't know how we readjust that. We can read it in our Bibles at home, but if we don't hear it from the pulpit, and it's dangerous because it's now you're in trouble because you're breaking the law. So to me, serving the master without question, the government can actually start stopping from serving. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, they can try. The question is, are we going to have our moral compass and the actions that we perform, these good works, according to what God has laid out for us, or are we going to allow our compass to be adjusted by those that are trying to redefine what is good and what is not? And I think that we're missing something sometimes that really lends itself to one of the things you just said, which is in the very next verse. Therefore, remember that formerly you, the Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision, by the so-called circumcision, which is performed in the flesh by human hands, remember that you were at that time separate from Christ, excluded from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who formerly were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. Paul is asking, from everything now that he's laid out in these first 10 verses, the contrast between who they were and what they have become, he's asking them to remember their former condition, to reflect upon who they used to be. And I think that's a very powerful instruction, because it allows the Gentiles of that time period to think back to exactly how bad off they were in terms of their life versus what God has prescribed to be good. They were as opposite as night and day. And when you take the time to reflect upon who you were and now see who you have become, it helps you to very clearly see the dividing line. I think we all need to follow this direction. And I know for myself, this is something that comes to my mind very frequently. Remembering who we formerly were. When we stop reflecting on who we used to be, isn't it awfully easy to forget where that line was? Doesn't that line get blurred? And don't we sometimes have a tendency to drift back into the very same lifestyle that apparently we were to have left behind? I think sometimes we need to step up our ability to remember who we were before Christ and who we are now, so that maybe we can see how far apart we were and how we were night and day away from a state of being justified before God. I think sometimes we drop the ball. The word Gentiles in verse 11, ethne, is actually, and if you can hear that word, we can get our word ethnic from that. Okay, it's a word that is referring to other nations. Okay, as a matter of fact, there are plenty of translations throughout the Old Testament, the prophets, where some translations will render the term Gentiles, others will simply just say nations, because the term Gentiles is referring to nations. The Jews would have looked at nations, and they would have looked at other nations. See, they recognized themselves as being the people of God, and so they were the other nations, which automatically put them in what type of position in the Jews' eyes? In a lost position. They're heathens. They're pagans. What does that say about the Gentiles? Again, from the Jews' perspective, what does that say about the Gentiles in terms of God accepting them? If you were a Jew and you looked at Gentiles as being other nations, you're lost. Now, consider what that's going to do to your idea of what God will and will not accept. And this is a part of the central problem. The Jews never in their right or wrong mind would have considered that these other heathen pagan people would ever be as acceptable to God as they themselves would be. And by the way, this word uncircumcision, that was coined by the Jews. Okay, circumcision was a term that had been around since the days of Abraham, but uncircumcision was a term that the Jews had coined, and primarily to be derogatory. Okay, it was an insult. Okay? It's along the same caliber of some of the terms that we would maybe unfairly refer to those that are not wise, okay, or are not smart, if you want to think about it that way. Okay, this uncircumcision would have been them thumbing the nose at the Gentiles, but what they didn't realize is what Paul was pointing out in the last part of verse 11. This circumcision, which is performed in the flesh by human hands, in today's language, that's an outpatient surgery. It's a minor surgical procedure provided by human hands. They put too much faith in the procedure instead of understanding that it was the relationship with God, at least the relationship that they were supposed to have with God, that made the sign mean something, not the sign itself. But look at the condition that they were in. So Paul's helping them try to remember what it was like. Remember that you were at that time separate from Christ, excluded from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who formerly were far off, have been brought near by the blood of Christ. There were five things in verse 12 that Paul is indicating the Gentile condition to have been. They were without Christ. They were excluded from the commonwealth of Israel. They were strangers to the covenants of promise. They had no hope, and they were without God in the world. Now, lest we rush through that and miss the point, let's think about what each one of those would have really meant. And that hopefully will give you a much better understanding of exactly where the Gentiles were. They were without Christ. Even the Jews at least had a genealogical connection with Christ. It was through the Jews that Christ came into the world. The Gentiles didn't even have that. But even more so, they didn't even know about the concept of the Messiah and Christ having been the Messiah. They were excluded from the commonwealth of Israel. That's saying that they are stateless. They really are nationless. We identify ourselves on one of the most basic level by the nation of which we are a citizen. I'm an American, right? They couldn't even do that, according to this description, because they didn't have a state in which to identify themselves. They were strangers to the covenants of promise. Strangers. They were foreigners. They were surrounded by those that had been offered protection through God's covenant, but they couldn't have that protection themselves. They were passers-by and could see the Jews, but yet they were somehow in this isolated little bubble. They had no hope. They didn't have any ground on which to hope. Now, I want to clarify this point because we can, in hindsight, look back as far back as the promise given to Abraham, and we know that the Gentiles would be accepted, correct? But did the Jews accept that? And were the Gentiles even aware of it? Those individuals, from their perspective, would have had no reason to hope. They wouldn't have had anything to hope in because they were not aware of God's promise. And the people that were aware of God's promise didn't accept it anyway. And then finally, without God in the world. Their gods weren't gods at all. And they did not recognize the authority of Yahweh. So who could they rely upon as a deity? No one. As a matter of fact, godless is really how this should be translated. It comes from the same root word, atheoi, which is from where we get our atheist. Now think about exactly what that combination of characteristics does to you if you are a Gentile. You are as far gone as you could be. Yes, sir. True.
I think to say all the Gentiles were just on their own is wrong. They had to have a law to follow. I don't know. I don't know the background of all of that, but they had to have something.
They had their own law. They had their law that would have allowed them to work within what they consider to be a moral structure of civilization. Okay? And in some cases, some of the secular laws that they would have come up with would have been the same types of things that the Jews themselves would have been expected to do. Okay? And you're right, there were individuals, Cornelius, for example, that would have understood the idea of a Messiah and the requirement to believe in Jesus, okay, and to have faith in God and Jesus to be saved. But when did that take place? Right.
But they had to have, I believe that they had that knowledge prior to that.
Well,
they didn't have the message with the gospel at that time, but they had to know something about what was going on.
In a limited sense, probably a few of them did, but they would not have really understood the hope that they could have had until after Jesus' sacrifice, his death, burial, and resurrection, after the day of Pentecost, as you've mentioned. Now, this is, and I bring this point up for a reason, though, and I'm glad that you mentioned that, because this is not intended to be a description of every individual Gentile that would have been a part of those nations. But collectively, would the Gentiles have not fit that description?
Well, I think it's general sense, yes.
And that's... Right, and that's the point. If you were talking about Gentiles overall, just as we did even in the beginning of Romans, if you look at the description of the actions that were listed in chapter 1, would each and every individual Gentile have maybe followed that exact same path? Probably not. But collectively, as these individuals, these nations, outside of the holy nation of God, would they have been guilty of those things? Probably. And I think that's what's going on here. Now, where it comes into play, though, is that the Jews, and that's what I said, I'm glad you brought this up, the Jews, even at this point in time, would have been guilty of looking at the individual and thinking of the nation. Paul is bringing up the point that as a nation, or nationless, really, because it was not given the revelations the Jews were given, that Paul was reminding them that before Christ, they were as far removed as they could get. These were the characteristics that they overall would have had. In the time of Christ, the Jews would have been guilty of looking at every individual Gentile and thinking in terms of what their perception of the Gentile nation would have been like, collectively. And that's where it gets dangerous. So I appreciate your point. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who formerly were far off have been brought near to the blood of Christ. All of these characteristics have caused them to be as far removed from Christ as they can. But now, because of the blood of Christ, they've been brought near to Him. They now know Him. Geographically, it's as if somebody had been in a completely different country, but now they're with us. Okay. Verse 14. For He Himself is our peace, who made both groups into one and broke down the barrier of the dividing wall by abolishing in His flesh the enmity, which is the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so that in Himself He might make the two into one new man, thus establishing peace, and might reconcile them both in one body to God through the cross, by having it put to death the enmity. He is our peace. Think of the volatile relationship that the Jews and the Gentiles had had all throughout history, even up to and including, I hate to say it, this time. How did the Gentiles view the Jews? Basically. Okay. How did the Jews view the Gentiles? Did either one trust each other? Did either one get along? No, as a matter of fact, it was such a volatile situation that there were historically some punitive measures that were cast upon the Jews by the Roman civilization, who the Jews, of course, would have called Gentiles. The Jews, of course, would have done everything that they could to rub the Gentiles' nose in the fact that, we are God's people. Okay, there were violent conflicts that would have happened throughout this time period. But through Christ, He's our peace. All of that volatile situation has been put to rest. And this idea of, and by the way, of course, you can see that the groups into is italicized. Again, that's an interpolation by the translators. Originally, it said, who made both one. Translators are just trying to help clarify exactly who the groups are, the Jews, the Gentiles. But He broke down the barrier of the dividing wall. Okay, in some cases, that would be translated as broken down the middle wall of partition between us. Now, most likely, that phrase is referring to the wall that would have been put up around the temple to separate the court of the Gentiles from the court of the Jews. That wall would have kept the Gentiles from entering into a territory that the Jews said was sacred and holy, and they were trying to keep the Gentiles out so that they would stay pure and would not be contaminated by the filth of the Gentiles. But what Paul is saying here is that the wall was broken down. There was no more division. And as a result, the Gentiles also could enter close to the temple of God. Yes, sir. Well, you're right. Well, that's right, and that's what he's saying in verse 15. But remember, Paul uses a lot of imagery throughout this discussion of the Gentiles' former condition, how they are now. So I believe that this is a device that is intended to allow the Gentiles, who would have understood Jewish temple structure, because they would have been living in and around it, they would have understood the idea of this wall keeping the Jews separately, you know, separate from the Gentiles. We're not allowed in there. Okay. Now, literally, what wall is he talking about? That's where verse 15 comes in. By abolishing in his flesh the enmity, which is the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so that in himself he might make the two into one new man, thus establishing peace. It was that law that was causing the problem. That was the enmity between the Gentiles and the Jews. The Gentiles didn't have the law, and the Jews looked at the law keeping, as far as their traditions go, as what had elevated them above the Gentiles. That separated the two groups. But now, through Jesus, the two groups have been made into one. They have been made peaceful because that has been removed, that dividing wall. Yes, John?
The enmity wasn't between the Jew and the Gentile. The enmity was between the people and God. There, that's the barrier, the dividing wall. The Jews looked at it as keeping the Gentiles out of the temple and that was the... But that's not where the enmity was really to be. Enmity was in between the Gentiles and the Jews and their relationship with God.
And ultimately, you're exactly right. Okay, ultimately, the division, and that's really where the next verses even go. You guys are just segueing right along here. That's where the next verses are really going. Because both groups ended up being separated from God. I mean, the whole idea of reconciliation that we're going to get to later on is this returning to God. It restores the relationship of the Jews and Gentiles alike to God. But even between the two groups, there was this division. So this is this. You're right in that the enmity separated all from God. But within the groups of the Gentiles and the Jews that he's been referring to, wasn't the law also a source of division between them? Okay, so I think that's where Paul is going right here. But then in the next step, he's going to talk about, now that you're one man, look at what it's done through your relationship with God. Okay? All right, thank you for your comments.